Premier Christian Newscast.
The horrendous attack on a mother and her children by Abdul Izzidi, an Afghan asylum seeker, in Clapham earlier this year sparked a ferocious row. A string of politicians and right-wing media outlets accused churches of giving asylum seekers like Izzidi bogus baptisms after they had fraudulently converted to Christianity to boost their arguments to not be returned to their home countries. The Archbishop of Canterbury was even accused in Parliament of, quote, scamming the British taxpayer. But is any of this actually true? How do churches in Britain work with and minister to asylum seekers? Should we be withholding baptism from someone who asks for it if we worry about the legitimacy of their conversion? And why have Christians become the lightning rod for politicians' anger over the asylum system in the first place? I'm Tim Wyatt, and this is the Premier Christian Newscast. This week, we're discussing asylum seekers, baptism and the church, with a panel including a bishop who herself came to Britain as a refugee, church leaders who serve asylum seekers in their own congregations, and activists working to help the church offer the welcome of Christ to those newly arrived in the UK. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. Really great to have such a fantastic panel for this podcast. Could I ask each of you to briefly introduce yourself? Mike, why didn't you go first?
Hi, my name's Mike Coates. I'm a vicar from Kensington in Liverpool, and I guess I'm here because our church community for somewhere around 8 to 10 years has worked because of the local community around within the areas of asylum and immigration. As part of our ministry into our local community.
Fantastic. Thanks for coming on. Steve, why don't you go next?
Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Tinning. I'm a Baptist minister. I work for the Baptist Union of Great Britain as their public issues enabler. And in that job, I work alongside my Methodist and URC colleagues campaigning and resourcing our churches on lots of justice issues, one of which is the hope of a society that welcomes the stranger, asylum and refugee issues. But before that, when I was a minister, I was part of a church that had welcomed a family of Syrian refugees into their community and housed them and had the joy and experience of supporting those in need of sanctuary.
Brilliant. Bishop, who are you?
Hello there. My name's Gully Francis Dehani. I'm the Bishop of Chelmsford. I am also one of the bishops who sits in the House of Lords. I arrived in this country myself at the age of 13 as a refugee from Iran. And I guess I should also say that the Diocese of Chelmsford, long before I arrived here, had a proud history of work with asylum seekers, refugees and migrants.
Brilliant. Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily Shepherd. I'm the CEO of Welcome Churches. We're a charity that exists to equip local churches around the UK to welcome people seeking refuge in their community in all sorts of different ways, whether they're people seeking asylum, people who've got their refugee status, people from Ukraine or Hong Kong, or whoever's arriving on their doorstep. So we've got about 1,400 churches that have connected with our Welcome Network, and we're just seeing that growing all the time.
And last but very much not least, Krish.
Hi everyone, nice to join you. My name is Krish Kandaya. I'm the director of the Sanctuary Foundation.
And what does the Sanctuary Foundation do for those who haven't come across it before?
So we try to sit between government, civil society and churches, the media, the academy and business to see what we can do to bring everybody around vulnerable people, particularly refugees. And our first use case was helping Ukrainian refugees.
Well, I'm really pleased to have all of you on the show. I'm looking forward to learning a lot, listening to your experiences. Obviously, we're having this conversation now because of the kind of conversation, the public debate that was sparked earlier this year by the horrible Al-Khali attack in Clapham, which subsequently believed to be carried out by a man who was an Afghan asylum seeker. And there was a whole storm of controversy about whether he had or had not been part of a church and whether he had or had not converted. And this kind of led to a claim, which I really want to just
a deal with First Up, which is from some politicians that churches in this country are facilitating bogus conversions to assist in asylum claims. Is there any evidence that this is actually happening, or is this just a kind of political talking point?
Shall I briefly
go for that, Gooley? Yeah,
somebody has to, don't they? To my knowledge, there has been no evidence put forward yet for what are really spurious claims and serious allegations that I think have done a lot of harm and have kind of turned the debate into something emotive and incredibly unhelpful. I was a witness before a select committee recently, and certainly no evidence came forward there that has since held water, including a Home Office minister who himself said that there was no evidence for the claims that the previous two of the previous Home Secretaries have made. I think this whole story has been riding on a storm of headlines and controversies and untruths, and it's done a lot of damage.
I agree, Bishop. And I was in a meeting where you, me and Tim Loughton were in the room, and Tim Loughton, the MP, had accused the Archbishop of Canterbury of deceiving the public and encouraging people to game the system, cheat the system, which I found quite offensive. I wonder whether he'd have a different view. He was recently deported from Djibouti. I wonder whether that's softened his own experience there. But the government's own guidance says that a senior minister, a clergy person or a priest is not a determining factor on whether someone is granted asylum or not. It's a contributing factor. And my reading of it is, just as many of us are asked to give job references for other people, we do so in good faith based on the evidence that we have. And if that person then goes and does something wrong, we're not ultimately responsible. All we're doing is presenting our evidence based on what we know of someone. So I do agree with you. This has been whipped up. It's part of the culture war that's developed around immigration. And it really saddens me that vulnerable people are used as a political football in electioneering. This seems to be what's going on, particularly with Rwanda right now.
And Emily, in your work with churches, are you finding a kind of backlash building as a result of this story? Is people's feeling about the work you do changing because they believe you're involved in some kind of bogus scheme to facilitate fake asylum claims?
I think the privilege of my work is to see churches around the country, first of all, welcome the stranger and take and be really excited about the opportunity that we have to welcome people from all sorts of different nations, all sorts of different backgrounds. And time again, we meet people saying, yes, what can I do? What can I do for these amazing people that are arriving on our doorstep? And the headline should be, what a privilege it is to meet these amazing people who are coming to all sorts of different communities around the UK, the majority of whom enrich our communities, enrich our churches, and we're all better off for knowing them. I think in terms of this conversation around baptism and everything that's snowballed since the attack in Clapham, our experience has been that churches are taking that really seriously. And yes, churches want to tell people about Jesus. They want to baptize people who want to follow Jesus. And that is a privilege and a freedom that we celebrate in the UK. But churches also don't want to baptize people who don't understand that and don't understand what it means to be baptized, because we're doing that person a disservice by doing that as well. And a few months ago, we had a call where we gathered churches together to talk about this and say, you know, this is what the news headlines have been. And what does that mean for our churches and our baptism policies and what the Home Office might ask us about that? And churches take that really seriously, and our church leaders take that really seriously. I think everyone else on here has a theology degree, so I'm probably the least qualified to talk about the theology of baptism on this call. But church leaders really hold that responsibility, I think, really well.
I guess we can say it seems clear that, there is no evidence for the kind of claims that, the government and others are making. But we shouldn't be naive to think that it's impossible that an asylum seeker might decide to try and game the system individually. Do you think there is a responsibility on church leaders to try and kind of weed out the true converts from the fake converts? I mean, Mike, in your experience as someone having to do this, did you try and discern, or is that just not the right question to be asking if someone is genuine or, faking it?
I believe now that it's not the right question to be asking, but I initially, when we began the process of looking at asylum locally and engaging with hearings and courts and standing in front of judges and whoever, we kind of panicked a bit, I think, and began to enable our baptism policies to answer the questions that were being asked of us. But as we began to settle, and quite quickly, we actually said, hold on a minute, what is our responsibility here? Our responsibility isn't to an asylum hearing. Our responsibility is to the individual in front of us. And actually, people come to church for lots of different reasons. And there is no doubt that some people will come to church and come to our church expecting to an easy ride and an easy road through to baptism, which they can then show as a certificate to say, look at us, we're people of faith and therefore we should stay. But I would look at the number of people who have been allowed to remain and the number of people who have moved through our church and say how many have continued in their journey of faith. And my experience of that is 99.9% of people who have been through the process of baptism and discipleship through our church process. They're not necessarily at church with us. Some are. But actually, when people get their leave to remain, they quite regularly move away into better housing, better accommodation, seeking jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But are engaging with their faith across the country. And we're in the right way, quite proud of the fact that we've been able to encourage people into faith along those lines. So now when we sit in front, now when we're asked questions about what this person's faith is like, then we're quite clear about what our baptism policies are. We're quite clear about what people can expect when they attend church. We are quite clear about what we can and cannot do. And we're happy to engage with anybody to say, listen, this is who we are. We're a relatively small church in Kensington and Liverpool, and this is what we do, this is what we believe, and this is how our policies are now in action. And this is the result of that, that people stay with their faith.
Steve, I'd love to know your thoughts on that one as well. Should ministers be trying to kind of selectively offer baptism to those they think are real and refuse it from those they think might be faking it?
Again, I find the question difficult because it implies that we're not, you know, as rigorous as we can be when anybody comes to us for baptism. It's a really important part, obviously, in the Baptist church. It's a really key part of who we are. So whether or not someone's an asylum seeker, an inquiry for baptism, you know, is more often than not followed up with a course to ensure that the inquirer understands what baptism is and isn't, that they can, you know, understand the declarations that they'll make at baptism, that they can explore church membership and the commitment and the covenant to the fellowship that it involves. All of these things are just essential to baptism, whether or not you're an asylum seeker. We were asked at the Home Affairs Select Committee if we keep records of how many asylum seekers we're baptising. And it's just, it's an anathema to me that we would even ask that question. It's much more about understanding a person's personal journey of faith. And also, you know, it's really key to recognise that baptism is not the end destination in somebody's conversion. More often than not, it's one of the first steps that they make on becoming Christian over the course of their life. So nobody's perfect. We do our best to understand the sincerity of their request and to take that extremely seriously. But certainly I wouldn't be saying to any Baptist minister, well, check to make sure they're not an asylum seeker, because if they are, we've got a different process for them. Do you know what I mean? That it's just not who we are.
I know. I was just going to bring in the issue that some of the people that we're talking about, you know, became Christians in their country of origin, and it's for that reason that they have had to flee and seek asylum here. Now, they may not have actually been baptized there. They might have been baptized there, but they might not have been, because it wasn't possible and it's illegal and all of those sorts of things. So we're not only dealing with people who come to us kind of completely fresh in faith, as it were. We're often dealing with people whose journey has brought them to this country because of their conversion or their desire to explore the Christian faith. And that sometimes gets forgotten or lost in the debate, I think.
Yeah. Can I just jump in? I know, Emily, you've got a lot to say as well, but that's particularly relevant of the church in Weymouth that has been has drawn a lot of attention in recent days. So a church that's had 25 to 30 asylum seekers from the Bibby Stockholm barge attending church in recent days. And if you Google it, if you read the headlines, it makes it look like these are all asylum seekers that were refused, that started queuing up at the church to get baptised to bolster their claims. But like Bishop Gooley says, seven of them were baptised by the time I last spoke to the church, all of whom had come to faith in their countries of origin. And the prospect of being baptised publicly in their country of origin was zero. It just wasn't possible. So, of course, they were keen to see that important part of their journey of faith fulfilled when they came to a country where that was possible.
And also on the back of that, I think sometimes we underestimate the courage it takes to be publicly baptized here. It's not the easy option because many of them are still fearful, and not just for themselves, should they get returned if their asylum claim hasn't been processed yet, but also for their families back home. So that the idea of standing up publicly, declaring your Christian faith is not something to be underestimated. It takes enormous courage for some.
Absolutely. I'm just getting really excited about this conversation because it connects us with the persecuted church in a very special way. And I think for the majority of listeners will be people who are part of churches around the UK. And what a privilege it is for us to have people in our communities who have taken huge risks for their Christian faith. And, you know, the persecuted church is no longer just people we read about on a newsletter and pray about in the distance, but they're real people in our churches. It's their friends, it's their families that we're praying for in their home countries. And I just think that's an absolute privilege for the Christian church to be able to know those people personally. And we had our welcome conference a few months ago, and that was for churches who were helping people seeking refuge, but also believers from a refugee background. And there was a man there who had followed Jesus secretly for 15 years in his home country since before coming to the UK. And I won't say what country it is because I don't want to put him at further risk, but that is. What an amazing privilege to be in the same room as him. Like that grows my faith, that inspires me in my walk with Jesus. And this is how God is blessing the UK church today. And that's just a really exciting conversation to be a part of.
One of the other things that's often said is that we shouldn't be surprised that the asylum seeker community might be, you know, more receptive to evangelism than the native British community, because they're often people who are ready to kind of explore new things, even if they haven't become Christians in their home countries, but they might be more open, or they might come from a cultural background very far removed from our kind of arid secularism of the West, and therefore much more open to genuine conversations about what we believe in this country and who we worship. And so actually, you know, does that ring true for people who've actually worked something, is that they might be more open to faith, even if they've never come across Christianity before?
Yeah, I would absolutely say, certainly speaking for Iranians, I come from Iran myself originally, you know, it's a generalization, but I think there's truth in it, that Iranians or people from the Middle East generally are naturally quite spiritual people. You know, the distinction between the social and national and religious and cultural are much less defined. So that they're naturally spiritual, and many of them are disillusioned with the faith that they now experience in their own home country, which has done them a lot of harm. It's a particularly fundamentalist version of Islam. And so they are absolutely open. They're wanting to explore, to discover something new. And then the churches are one of the few places where they find a genuine warmth of welcome. So it isn't surprising that people are drawn to this. And I suppose the thing I'm concerned about is, why has this become such a battleground, as it were, between some politicians and some of the media and churches who are, and other civil groups, civic groups, who are trying to play our part in building healthy communities. So this shouldn't be something that we battle over. I think we have very distinct roles. You know, government and the Home Office have their role to play, and they should play it properly. It's not our role to assess asylum claims. It's our role to offer welcome, journey alongside people, and if baptism seems like the right thing, in discernment with them, to do that. That in no way is overriding the Home Office or government's responsibility to assess claims efficiently, treat people with dignity, and where necessary, return people. The problem is, I think the whole system is in such chaos that it's very easy for accusations to fly around, and people are looking for places to put blame, as it were. And because of the stance, particularly of bishops in the House of Lords on the whole illegal migration bill and Rwanda and so on, I think there is a lot of frustration towards the Church of England particularly, and unfortunately that then bleeds out and kind of affects other church communities too. So I want to say that very carefully, because I don't want to add to the slinging of allegations, as it were, but I think this is what concerns me. How do we get to a place where we work in a more healthy and generous way with government rather than just throwing accusations around?
I think that's right, Bishop. There seems to be quite an adversarial culture developing, not just when it comes to migration, but we've seen it with disability benefits recently, school attendance at schools versus parents. And I think that's somewhere where churches, the Christian community, can live up to our calling as peacemakers. Like, can we find common ground? How can we reset the conversation? We saw that with the Ukraine program, for example. That was government and civil society and churches working together to try and find positive solutions to help people. We saw that with Afghan refugees. Government didn't have any resource. Who could they ask to help to step in? So they call on churches to kind of be there alongside hotel managers. So I do think we need a reset. That might mean a reset of which party's in government, but maybe it's possible to have a reset even with this government and just say, look, this blame throwing, this accusatory, adversarial culture doesn't help anybody. It leaves the vulnerable more vulnerable and worse off.
I do recognise, and have recognised for a number of years, a kind of politically driven hostile environment towards asylum seekers and refugees. And I think it's becoming worse because that hostile environment hasn't worked. And one of the reasons I think it hasn't worked is because the church has offered a sense of love and community into people's lives, which, and you know, I agree with Emily, which is a real privilege. It's a huge privilege to be involved in anybody's life. But when you hear the stories and you sit alongside and you journey with people who've been through quite remarkable experiences and come out the other end strengthened in their faith, you know, we have so much to learn from them. But that hostile environment, you know, makes things really difficult for them about their housing standards, about the amount of money they receive, about the fact that they can't work. And we can go on and on and on, hitting things in the way that the systems are grossly unfair. And I think the church needs to be in that place where it questions government and where it stands up for the rights of refugees. And I do recognize that there are conversations that we need to have in a more gentler way. But I also think we kind of need to be just as public about the condemnation, about the way people are treated through the asylum system, and possibly even be more outspoken than we are now.
And how can the church steer us back into something more compassionate, less toxic? How can the church model a better way of talking about asylum? Because, you know, of course, within the church, Christians disagree about the politics of asylum and migration and what the right levels are. And even on big things like the Rwanda scheme, I'm sure you could, if you looked, you could find Christians in favor of it. So how can the church model a way of having these important conversations, but without it becoming so toxic and poisonous and hateful?
I think when you get down to the nitty gritty of policy details, I think the church can be quite, you know, representative of the wider society. When it comes down to the welcome of a stranger, it is a fundamental explicit teaching throughout the whole of Scripture, and I would challenge any Christian that wanted to question that. So it's not so much about the if as it is the how. And I think churches have a lot to offer that. I mean, bluntly, as we've said already, policy is the work of the government. The church is here, firstly, to challenge and to question any immorality that comes through some of those policies. So I'm with Mike. I do think that the church should be speaking up loud and clear when they see things that are horrific on this. But I also recognise that the church's posture should be one of compassion and not of conflict. So, yeah, we should be making a case for safe routes better. We should be telling stories about how community sponsorship has been so warmly embraced by a lot of church communities and is still a very live and active and possible way of welcoming asylum seekers and refugees into your community. But as JPIT, as the Baptist, Methodist and URC Church, we don't think that the most effective way of going about a campaign is to see a policy issue that we object to, do a sort of policy analysis of it and write a public statement that condemns it and ask our senior leaders. This is what we've, like, sadly, this is what we've had to resort to because of some of the difficulty in relationship that we've got. But this isn't the most effective way of doing it. It just, like you say, adds to the mudslinging. So we're sort of moving into a new era of our campaigning where we're recognising the grassroots movement of our churches is the most effective way to build support for things. And so we're going to start something called the Constituency Action Network, where we build a network of at least one church in each constituency in the country. So when policies come up that we find difficult and that we want to challenge, instead of mudslinging in the national newspapers, we've got a church that is intentionally building a purposeful and positive relationship with their MP and can make the arguments in the context of relationship so that message is heard from the ground up. And I think that's an important distinction that we're hoping to move towards more effectively.
I think that's really helpful, Steve. And I you know, I've listened very carefully to what you say. In the end, grassroots movements and simply modelling something in local communities is going to be incredibly fruitful. There is a question, I think, particularly, I guess, for those of us who are in the House of Lords, for example, or who have a public platform, about how to use our voices well. And I think that... you know, that takes wisdom and discernment and all, and absolutely not mudslinging. I'm not interested in that. So one of the other factors, I think, in this whole debate is being use of language. You know, even the language of hostile environment, which crept in, says something, that the language around swarms and migrants and boats and all that, you know, means we forget that we're talking about human beings and individuals with stories and so on. So temperate language in whatever we're saying and at whatever level seems to me really important. And a willingness to listen. You know, I was really struck when I went to the Home Affairs, the Select Committee. I didn't feel that the majority of the people on that Select Committee were really interested in listening to what I was trying to say. I went genuinely wanting to say, look, there's been a whole lot of noise about this. Let me try and explain what it's like from our perspective. They just weren't interested. And until we're, you know, they were just feeding lines, as it were, that they'd already decided what their view was, the majority of them. That environment makes it really, really difficult to have a sensible adult conversation. It doesn't get us anywhere. So away from the headlines, away from the toxic language. And there's something about middle ground here for me. You know, social media and all of those things just feed to the extremes. So either you're for or you're against. Either you're baptizing in order to be part of a conveyor belt of scamming the system, or you're against immigration. Actually, the helpful, serious debate takes place in the centre ground, where we say there's nuance, there's complexity, there are individual cases that have to be understood. So that's why podcasts like this are helpful, because they allow the scope and the space for that. Whereas very often, media headlines, so on, they're not interested in that. They just want the quick response. And it doesn't speak effectively enough to the complexity of all of this.
And not only that, but it's really dangerous. Like I was so appreciative of your input in that Home Affairs Select Committee, Bishop Cooley. I thought the questions that you were asked, like you said, didn't afford you the opportunity to share the message that you had to share. And you know, I finished my contribution to that committee by referring to specific examples of how churches and communities have been threatened, using language that mirrors that which has been seen from our MPs and the media. And the church in Weymouth, you know, were sent, I gave one example of an email that they were sent that said, "You need shutting down, the backlash from this will be huge. The truth is, you know, you're lying and cheating the system, treacherous to tax paying people. Brace yourself." And when a small church that is just innocently trying to do what the gospel has called them to do start receiving messages like that, we have to say to those in power, you do need to temper your language. These words are misleading, grossly exaggerated, and intentionally incendiary, and it has an impact. And those things need to be called out. But like I said, you know, there are other conversations that go on that aren't in the headlines of the media, conversations with the Home Office and the church that are, I think, more hopeful in helping us learn from one another. How does the Home Office decision makers have a system that is more effective in understanding a person's journey to faith? And how do we as churches give guidance to our ministers and to those in on the ground to understand their role in tribunals and decision making processes more effectively? Those conversations are happening, and that gives me hope. But it doesn't make the headlines because it doesn't get votes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Steve. And you know, I know you're one of those who's working with the Home Office about, you know, the guidance around baptism and how best to assess conversion and so on. And I would just say about the Select Committee that, you know, the heat very much was on me and the Church of England. But actually, Steve, you were the star of the show right at the end. No, those comments you made were very, very profound. And I think they did make an impact in the room. And I'm really grateful to you for them.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Premier Christian Newscast. Premier Christian Newscast.
Mike, I wanted to ask you, you're presumably, your work with Asylum Seekers is not a secret, it's kind of known in your community. Have you ever experienced a backlash from parishioners or people further afield in Liverpool who are angry about what you're doing or think that you're somehow, you know, being treacherous to the taxpayer?
Yes, we work hard at developing relationships and following journey with people. And we see that as an essential part of then earning the voice to be able to be slightly more public in debates such as this. And so when we begin to engage with those debates, we put some letters into our local newspaper, the Liverpool Echo. And my understanding was within 5 minutes, the website had crashed because of the number of anti comments into the stuff that we were saying. And we were talking about hospitality and love and grace and understanding people as people. And you know, we've had nails thrown across the car park, and just not from within the congregation. The congregation are hugely supportive and understand what we're about and work hard to enable hospitality to be a key ingredient into our church community. And we don't just work with Asylum Seekers. There are a number of other ministries that outreach into a tough urban community as well. And so we are keen to ensure that our day-to-day ministry and work is reflected in the conversations that we have. Quite often, particularly with Asylum Seekers, it's difficult to mention name, and it's difficult to have particular story, and it's, you know, even the person who helps us with our interpretation won't go on camera because of his fear of the the effects in Iran. And so we kind of gather that day by day, and we work as hard as we can to enable people to be dealt with and seen as human beings and recognized in that way against a system that, as we've already said, chooses not to. But we also recognize that we have a public voice, and we try and express that public voice in ways that we can.
I think that's really helpful to hear, Mike, because it's often the churches that are being the bridge between communities. So like yourselves, but also others. Last year when there were protests outside hotels that where people seeking asylum were being placed, it was often local churches that were providing safe havens for people seeking sanctuary, but also being the people who were trying to mediate with other local groups who are feeling the anger and feeling hostility. And it's the churches are really getting caught up in the middle of these extreme positions, as Bishop Gully was saying. And I think one of the key takeaways for anyone listening to this is to pray for church leaders, pray for Bishop Gully and Steve. You know, when I was listening to the select committee, I just tried to pray for you both as much as I possibly could, because I just recognized how important that was. But I think that is true for all of our church leaders in this, that you all really need our prayers, and we need to stand together.
One thing that has, I guess, got a bit lost in this, because there's been so much focus on supposedly kind of fake conversions, is the other angle is that I'm sure you'll all know stories of people who were really Christians, but the Home Office decided that they were faking it because the Home Office just lacks the ability or the religious literacy to be able to truly kind of discern and determine. Is that a big issue in your experience, that people's actual faith, maybe even stretching back decades to their country of origin, is not being properly recognized or is being dismissed as fraudulent?
Regularly, I think that's a regular day-to-day thing, where people will say, hold on a minute, I know that my faith is real to me, that I'm expressing it daily, but when I've put my application in, it's been knocked back on the strength of this. And even when I've stood up before whoever and had conversation and said, listen, this is what we feel, it's not an individual thing, it's a kind of leadership team thing, it doesn't come from one person, although I'm the only one here, and that we begin to address those issues, then probably 3 or 4 in 10 successful, and the rest not successful, in the sense that the people in front of us have not heard what's been said by the person concerned. And that could well be because of a sentence or a moment of fear or something that's been said early in the process, or some way that they've expressed their question of faith and their understanding of faith. And it doesn't fit within what, as you've already mentioned, is quite narrow Home Office parameters.
I mean, I've heard stories of the kind of questions that people get asked sometimes in interviews, you know, like bizarre things like, what were the names of the three wise men, or what color is a Bible, these kind of nonsensical questions to Christians like us that just don't really have any bearing on how you would determine someone's real faith. Do churches need to help the Home Office to kind of train their people better so they can actually ask more meaningful questions in these contexts?
I think that's right, and I think Steve will have more to say to this because he's more directly involved, but I think all this points to the fact that it is ultimately very, very difficult to assess whether somebody's faith is genuine or not. You know, that there is no kind of cast iron set of criteria that we can use. And actually, you know, if we're honest, the truth is that's true for all of us. You know, our faith waxes and wanes. We have periods of doubt and questions and things, elements within faith that we might struggle with, and so on and so forth. So it's really difficult to pinpoint and say we've come up with a perfect solution, and if only these boxes are ticked, then, you know, we can assess someone's faith. I just don't think that's possible. But I do think that we can do some work with the Home Office to help them understand some of the complexity of that. And I'd really be interested to know what Steve thinks about that.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury and members of the Church of England had helpfully asked to engage the Home Office on some of this stuff after the headlines were done. And there was a what I felt was quite a positive meeting with the Home Secretary and others in the room at that time. He was a good listener. You know, I'm just going to say it from my perspective. Others in the room might have had a different thing, but we had sort of half an hour scheduled, and 45 minutes later we were still there with him as some of his aides were trying to put him away. But he wanted to listen, he wanted to hear, and I came away quite encouraged by that. Now, some of the reporting of that meeting since has saddened me that it hasn't necessarily gone that way, but it has triggered now an opportunity for some of the churches that were in that meeting and representatives from different denominations to draw alongside civil servants in the Home Office and look at this and say, well, what are the criteria that you are? And they've made progress. Like a lot of the stories that you hear about, you know, a Bible pop quiz are quite, come from examples from a few years ago. So they are recognizing and trying to make progress. But I'm really encouraged that they want to meet with us and talk about this. And I think it's in humility we want to say none of our churches and institutions are perfect either, and our guidance needs reviewing, and you can help us do that. And that's what I'm trying to say. But these things genuinely don't make the headlines because there aren't votes in it. So I want the listeners of this show to be encouraged that those conversations are happening. I hope that they will be fruitful. The first one meaningful. We've had one already to sort of set up the parameters for it, but the next one's tomorrow, and we're really looking forward to seeing how productive and helpful it will get. But I think I just want to say it's really important that these conversations happen, because we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The truth is there probably are some examples, small examples, of places where churches have been duped and asylum seekers have pulled the wool over their eyes. But I'd like to think that, well, as we've said, there's very little evidence that this is a systemic thing, and we want to be better at trying to understand what that is. But as Bishop Cooley said, there is no, I'd love to give the Home Office the questionnaire that can determine fully where it is. And like I said earlier, baptism is not the end result of someone's perfect journey to faith. It is often one of the first steps. And so they are imperfect. We're all imperfect people becoming more Christian even after baptism. The last thing that I'd want to say is that we had another headline a couple of weeks ago, sadly, of an asylum seeker who was going to one of our Baptist churches and was stabbed by another asylum seeker. And so the headlines kicked off, and there were certain emphases in the different ways that this story was told. Sadly, another man was killed who wasn't an asylum seeker, who's just out innocently walking by after, and he barely gets a mention in any of these articles. And that's the real tragedy of the story. But of course, you know, the good news is the asylum seeker that had been stabbed has now received refugee status. And I just keep thinking, what if he hadn't been stabbed? Would he have had his asylum claim heard? Would there be that recognition? Or did it take proof that his life as a Christian was properly under threat, not just at his home country, but in this country as well? And it really sort of drove home to me what an unjust system we currently exist in, that it would take an action like that for somebody to be heard. Current policies in place by the government won't even listen to somebody's asylum claims, let alone assess whether or not they're genuine. And that's the real challenge that we've got in front of us.
I think it's important for people to remember that seeking asylum in the UK is not an easy ride, and sometimes our media makes it sound like it is, but for everybody coming and going through that process, it's really difficult. You don't know when you're going to get your interview from the Home Office, you don't know when they're going to give you an answer, you don't know where your legal aid options are very limited, you're not allowed to work, you don't have a choice over where you're living. There are so many hurdles and so many difficulties that it is really difficult, without trying to make the whole process even more difficult by sending people to Rwanda as well.
Hmm. Mike, you wanted to say something on that one as well? Hmm. And I think, you know, from the outside, as someone who's not an expert in this world, it does seem pretty clear that a large degree of this debate has arisen because the government is looking for someone to blame for its own kind of failures over the migration and asylum system, and its own frustration at not being able to deliver what it wanted to deliver. And obviously it's politicians find it hard to take credit responsibility for their own failures, and so potentially they're look casting around looking for someone else to take the blame. Just a final thought then before we close. Excuse me. Just a final thought before we close. Do you think the church should be a bit more loud and proud about its ministry in this area and not be kind of cowed or reticent? Or is the wise course to keep doing what we're doing, not don't get our heads blown off and just do the work that you guys are doing on the ground quietly in the background?
I think it's really important not to get drawn into conversation in the extremes, so that we the extremes of language, whether for political or whether it's a newspaper, just our areas are that we really shouldn't be drawn into so much. But actually, we keep loving people, keep caring people, keep doing our day-to-day work, and then enabling that to be our voice into a conversation of reasonableness. Because I think most people are reasonable. I think most people will listen to reasonable conversations. And I think most people would want the church to be and to stand exactly where we do at this moment. And it's yes, we need to be a bigger voice. Yes, we need to, in my opinion, say more publicly, but just not allow ourselves to be drawn into the extremes of conversation.
I mean, I do. I'm really conflicted here because I totally see the practical sense of quietly getting on with it, and I just think there's that phrase, isn't there? Be the change that you want to see in the world. I think that the narrative, the conversation that needs to be had, isn't necessarily with government but wider society, and if we can model something that says, Look at how our country can be a compassionate country. You often hear it said, don't you? Oh, we're a compassionate country. Look at everything that we've done for asylum seekers and refugees. More often than not, we're pointing all the way back to the kinder transport for examples of how that's true. And yes, the Syrian vulnerable person salmon scheme and the recent Ukrainian scheme, I think, are good examples of that as well. But it's in those experiences where people come alongside asylum seekers and refugees that their minds are changed, because they actually see them as human beings, people that are real. Today in the news, the face of the poor 7-year-old girl who died in the English Channel was in our newspapers, and I'm desperately conflicted in that because I don't want it to be a manipulative thing where people's emotions are stirred. But truthfully, I got involved in asylum and refugee things back in 2015 when Alan Kurdi's body was plastered all over our newspapers. And I do think that sort of personal interaction and that sort of realizing the humanity of people that we're dealing with is a really important part of this, and churches have a fundamental and key part to play in expressing that welcome in practical ways, all the while saying, this is who we should be, this is who we are as a church, this is who we should be as a country. Anyone that suggests that we shouldn't be doing that need to understand that they're asking us to deny a fundamental aspect of our role and our identity. So it's trying to have the integrity of yes on the ground. It's the Desmond Tutu thing, isn't it, that we're pulling people out of the stream. It's about time we go upstream and find out what's going in. There is the practical hands-on work that we have to do to reach out to those who are suffering, but we also have a role to go upstream and campaign politically to understand what are the causes of the reasons why people are having to leave their country, and what are the reasons why in the UK it's difficult to welcome them and receive them.
I completely agree with that. I think it's both. And I think it was Mike earlier said that your church has all kinds of different ministries. It's not just around work with asylum seekers. Clergy and congregations respond to need in their local context, whatever that need might look like. And I absolutely fundamentally believe that the church, whatever denomination it is, its best expression is the local. It's the getting on with it. It's the building relationship. It's living compassionate lives, always honest, transparent, within the bounds of law, all of those things. But compassion and treating people with dignity, and particularly those who are marginalized, those who we might consider different to ourselves and so on. But at the same time, we can't just ignore it when the headlines just are untrue or are saying things that are feeding controversy unnecessarily. All of these things take wisdom, but I think our voices need to be heard at that level. But ultimately, the real work is done at the local.
And I think there's a responsibility for each church to be involved in this in some way. That, you know, that's why Welcome Churches exists, is because we really truly believe that it's part, as others have said, it's part of the Christian faith to practice hospitality, to welcome the stranger, and so many other reasons why we should be welcoming refugees today, that every church in the UK should be thinking, how do we welcome people in our local context? Because every church does have the opportunity in some way now. I think that's one of the exciting things happening in the UK, is that we all have the opportunity to get involved in this. And I do genuinely think that it should be as normal, if not more normal, for churches to be welcoming refugees as it is to have a Sunday school. That, you know, we all, our churches set up and we think, okay, what are we doing for our children? We should be saying, what are we doing for the stranger? What are we doing for the outsider? What are we doing for people arriving? Because we see that in the Bible throughout it, time and time again. We all need to be saying, what else can we do here?
And Tim, just to finish, I would like to encourage churches as well, if many do anyway, is to find out who your local people are who can support you in this kind of a ministry, because there will be people around, whether you're rural or within a city, who are working hard to make the life of refugees better. And whether it's Welcome Churches, which I would absolutely recommend, or whether it's a local organizations that you can connect with, you can support, possibly even financially support, and enable them to do their job as experts in these fields, so that you can do the walking along and pastoral care, and then the experts can get on with their stuff, continually supported by you. Because it to do it on your own, it's too much, really, I think. But once you begin to network, and once you begin to find areas of support, then you can find quite a lot of extra work being done with you and for you in supporting people and helping the process through quicker.
Well, that's a great place to draw our conversation to a close, I think. A nice, uplifting, positive place. Thank you so much to each of you, Guli, Mike, Steve, Emily. Chris sadly had to leave us a little earlier, but thank you to him as well. Really great to have your experience and your reflections on this important topic. And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
That's it for this week's Premier Christian Newscast. But before you go, please do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice, and why not tell a friend about the show too? And if you'd like even more church news analysis, you can also subscribe to my new free email newsletter, The Critical Friend. Each week I send an email packed with links to interesting things happening in the church world and my commentary on them. Just visit tswyatt.substack.com to find out more and subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Premier Christian Newscast.